Welcome back. This lecture will focus on the Swedish cinema because during World War One, the biggest Swedish film company emerged as a very significant competitor to the Danish film industry. Before World War One, Nordisk had been by far the biggest film company in the Scandinavian countries, with a large world market, and even the biggest Swedish company was much smaller and had a considerably smaller production than Nordisk. But the outbreak of World War One changed the balance considerably, also because the outbreak of the war meant that international trade became much more difficult. And Nordisk, far more so than some other countries, relied on the international market. Something like 95% of their turnover came from the international market. The Danish home market was really economically insignificant to the company. But the outbreak of the war meant that trade barriers went up, and that trade was inhibited considerably, and this only worsened over the course of the war, and with the outbreak of or with the declaration of unconstrained submarine warfare by the Germans in 1917, stopped sort of transatlantic and ocean going shipping altogether, and this meant that Nordisk had no way of getting their films to the overseas markets that had provided them with an important part of their business. And even within Europe, they had problems because their company, they tried to, Denmark was neutral during the war, and Nordisk tried to keep up a posture of neutrality. After the outbreak of the war, they made several war films, but they used uniforms that did not belong to any European country, with the hope that they could export the films to both sides of the struggle. However, Nordisk had considerable business interests in Germany, and that meant that the Entente powers, principally England and France, were very suspicious of Nordisk's films, and they were worried that it appears not entirely without reason that Nordisk would attempt to sell German films to England and France under the guise of these films being Danish productions. They didn't want that, so gradually the British and the French market was closed off, and Nordisk sort of went into the German market big time in as an attempt to protect their position. Russia was also a big market for Nordisk, and that closed down with in 1917 as well. But Nordisk and Ole Olsen was very conscious as the war went on that the American film industry would be the by far the most significant competitor by the time that the war ended. The French film industry had been devastated by the war. Many, many workers in the French film industry, which was the biggest film industry before 1914, had been called up. Many had been killed in action, and production had plummeted. And that meant that the sort of the market shares that the French film industry had in the overseas markets, in particular, they couldn't. Those were left open. Nordisk wasn't really able to compete either, and Hollywood filled up the vacuum. And because the United States wasn't involved in the war till 1917, they were sort of protected from direct effects, and the American home market was huge, and that allowed Hollywood to develop very, very swiftly, precisely during the time when the European film industries were hobbled by the war. And Olsen was very aware of what was happening in the United States, and he predicted in 1916 that once the war was over, the Hollywood would, and of course the American film industry had just started to move to Hollywood at this time, so calling it Hollywood is kind of maybe sort of misleading, but still okay, I think. Anyway, Olsen was Olsen predicted that once the war was over, the American film companies would flood the European market with new and well-made films, and they would be able to sell them very, very cheaply, because they had already earned their money back and more in the very large American home market. So so the American companies would be able to put these films on the European market at prices that would be much lower than what European companies would need to charge from distributors and cinema owners. And so the competitive landscape looked very difficult, and Olsen saw this, and what he proposed to do was to try to get a big home market for Nordisk as well. And the sort of Denmark was a tiny country, but Germany was close by, and Germany was a very large country. So basically what Olsen tried to do during the war was to take over the German film market and get Nordisk sort of a controlling interest there, in order to have a strong home market where Nordisk's films could realistically compete against the American ones. And in many ways that was a rather a far-sighted plan that he came up with. And Nordisk kept up production for several years during the war, even though they weren't able to distribute the films, and they, in a sense, they made a bet that once the war was over, they too would be able to release these films onto a hungry market. The problem was that while the American cinema developed by leaps and bounds during the war years, the Danish cinema didn't quite do the same. And although you can see there are some differences between a Danish film from 1918 and one from 1914. They still are relatively similar in both their style and their subject matter, and whereas the Americans had developed new ways of storytelling that for many spectators were much more exciting. They'd come up with new highly attractive stars like William S. Hart and Charlie Chaplin and so on. So that part of Nordisk's proposal turned out to be a really bad bet, that the making all these films would turn out to be a really poor investment, because a lot of them were basically worthless once the war was over. all that by way of introduction. For the rest of the lecture, I'll talk first about what the Swedes did during the same period, and how they came up with sort of a new production concept and what is sometimes referred to as the national film. Then I'll say something more about the perhaps most important of the Swedish directors, Victor Sjöström, and finally about I'll talk about Mauritz Stiller and some other directors active then. But in Sweden, the biggest film company was called Svenska Biografteatern, which means Swedish cinemas, and it had started out, as many film companies did, with a chain of cinemas, and they'd started making their own films to supply their cinemas, and it had grown to become a rather important company. But they had the advantage, compared to Denmark, that it was legal for the film company to own its own cinemas. And sort of one important constant in film history has been that if you want to make money from film, the way to do it is to own the cinemas where the money comes in. One reason why the Hollywood, the big Hollywood companies were so successful during their classical period was that they controlled their own cinema chains. And Svenska Bio similarly owned a large chain of cinemas in Sweden. In Denmark, you couldn't do that because cinema ownership was you had to have a license from the police, and the police refused to allow cinema chains to be built up, and some of the pioneers found ways around this, but basically the industry was the cinema ownership was highly regulated in Denmark. It was even worse in Norway, where local authorities, municipalities, gradually took over Norwegian cinemas and sort of used the profits from the cinemas to pay for all the stuff that local authorities, you know, need to pay for, schools and that kind of thing, rather than investing the money in making new films, which meant that it was really, 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 really hard to fund films in Norway, and why Norway didn't have any kind of film infrastructure. They didn't have any studios or anything till after the coming of sound in 1930. Anyway, Svenska Bio's production policy from 1912 to 1916 basically relied on making films that were quite similar to the ones that Nordisk was making in the same period. So you had a lot of you had melodramas about infidelity and illegitimate children. Not as many of those as because Swedish censorship was much more strict, and you had a lot of crime melodramas of various sorts, typically ones that took place in sort of vague cosmopolitan milieu, so they weren't sort of tied to particular places. Often the characters would have French or English names to sort of suggest this kind of cosmopolitanism. And as an example of this, I have a clip here from a film that Victor Sjöström made in 1916 called The Kiss of Death, a crime drama in three acts, which has a really, really complicated plot, which I've tried to figure it out, but I couldn't really. Sjöström plays a dual role. Again, the special effects are quite impressive, and so you see him interacting with himself. But in the scene here, the plot involves some technical drawings that contain an important secret that various characters want to get hold of, and one of the Sjöströms and a friend suspects that bad guys will try to steal the plans, so they lie in wait during the night, and sure enough, a criminal turns up. In the evening, we made our preparations. It's Sjöström here on the left with the gun. Gas. Once again, I saw the mysterious figure. Felt my pulse and said, strange, this isn't Weiler. That Weiler is the other Sjöström. Then he tried to break into the safe. Sleeping gas and doubles and safe cracking and helmets with built-in gas guns, and you know, it's delightful, but you know, kind of unserious maybe, but certainly very much sort of along the lines of these are this is a melodramatic genre film with sort of made for entertainment, and Nordisk at the same time also made a lot of these kinds of crime films, and at one point Svenska Bio actually sort of pulled off the same stunt that Nordisk had done earlier. They plagiarized one of Nordisk films. This was early on in 1912-13. Nordisk had made a very, very successful film called Death Leap from the Circus Dome, which was sort of based on an actual incident where a trick that involved a circus artist who was riding a horse, and the horse was on a platform which was raised up into the Circus Dome, and fireworks were set off, and he had to control the horse and keep it from leaping off the platform. And he didn't. This was thought to make great movie material. So Nordisk made a film about that, and Svenska Bio ripped it off and made a very, very similar film of their own. But towards the end of 1916, Charles Magnusson, who was the head of Svenska Bio, decided to change his production policy and to move away from this kind of approach. And at the time, Svenska Bio had 5 full-time directors, and he fired 3 of them and kept only 2, Maurits Stiller and Victor Sjöström, because he thought that those 2 were the most skilled and reliable ones, and he decided to reduce the number of films that the company made every year from I think something like 25 to 5, so that each director, instead of making maybe 5 or 6 films in the course of a year or even more, they would just make 2 or perhaps sometimes 3, but no more than that. So that each film would represent a much higher investment, and that the extra time and cost would allow for each film to have a higher quality, and so to make up in attractiveness of each title what was lost in volume, and at the same time this also there was also a deliberate effort to make to change the genres, the kinds of films that were made, in the direction of more prestigious subject matter, allowing the company to sort of move away from or to gain prestige. And in Sweden, there was, like in Germany, sort of a very there were powerful public voices that were very suspicious of films and filmmaking, because they were thought to be especially attractive to young people and to the lower classes, and because a lot of them were about crime and so on, they could very easily give bad ideas to people. And Swedish censors were very concerned about, for instance, a scene like this, where, you know, you see how to open a window from outside. That was a bad thing, because it might sort of teach you criminal techniques. And so, you know, and that, of course, made it more difficult to make fun crime films. And so one solution was, well, you know, let's not make any more crime films, let's do something different instead. And the film that sort of inaugurated the new policy was Terje Vigen from 1917, which was based on a very well-known poem by the great Norwegian author Henrik Ibsen, and it premiered in January of 1917, and was enthusiastically received. It was sort of a big event. It premiered simultaneously in both Stockholm and two other big Swedish cities, and in Copenhagen. There were very elaborate program booklets published for the film, and for the first time, the leading Stockholm newspapers sent their theatrical reviewers to do the reviews of the film. And so there was, in that way, sort of already showed that they had sort of successfully managed to acquire the kind of cultural prestige that they were looking for. Nordisk distributed the film in Germany, and so they were aware of what Magnusson was doing even before the film was released. The story of Terje Vigen takes place during the Napoleonic Wars, when Norway was under Danish sovereignty, and because Denmark supported Napoleon, the British had a naval blockade, which meant that there was widespread hunger in Norway, and the hero tries to get, he rows across the water to get food for his family, but he's caught by a British naval vessel and thrown in jail and sits there for 7 years, and when he comes back, his wife and children have died from hunger. And he goes mad. But at the climax of the film, he is confronted once again with the British naval captain, who refused to show him mercy, and he has the naval captain and his family at his mercy. And sort of what does he do then? That's sort of the climax of the film. Germany, of course, in 1917, was under a naval blockade from the British, and there was widespread hunger in Germany as well at the time, so the film had, in that sense, sort of a direct appeal to German filmgoers, without sort of in any explicit way taking sides in the ongoing World War. Which may or may not have been deliberate, but the film got glowing reviews, not least due to Sjöström's performance in the title role and the way that his sort of the madness that grips him after he has learned his family is gone is reflected by the crashing of the waves upon the stony shore where he lives a secluded existence. This is just after he's returned and learned that his wife and children have died. So, Sjöström carries on a number of the kinds of expressive devices that we've seen in earlier and contemporary films. He uses aperture framings. He uses shooting against the light to create silhouette effects and other similar devices, but you have the presence of sort of the location, the wild nature surrounding the characters pushed much more to the front than had hitherto been common. And Sjöström followed it up with a film called The Outlaw and His Wife, Bjergejeren og hans hustru, which takes place in Iceland, and they couldn't go to Iceland because of the unrestricted submarine warfare. So the film was shot in the north of Sweden, but still it much of the film is set outside and uses the dramatic landscape to sort of reflect and energize the passions of the characters. And then after that, he made an even more ambitious film called The Sons of Ingmar Sönerne, which was released in two parts, each around 2 hours long. So it's a really, really big film. It doesn't survive entirely complete, but we have, I mean, it's been shortened at some point, but sort of the bulk of the film is there. And that was based on actually just the first two chapters, I think, of a novel by the writer Selma Lagerlöf. And she had won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1909, was the first woman to do so, and was one of the most one of the sort of living Swedish writers who was held in the highest regard, and her works were also translated into many languages, and she was very well known at the time. The Outlaw and His Wife was also based on that was based on a play, but by again by a well-known writer. So in each case, the films were based on important literary works, and that was something that was sort of felt to add to their prestige. And with Ingmar Sönerne, it's a Swedish work, and the story takes place in the early 19th century or the late 18th century in rural Sweden. So the characters wear these kinds of national costumes, it was felt by many reviewers that the film had this, and you can see also the poster design here sort of evokes Swedish folk art, and it was thought by many that there was something particularly Swedish about these films, and so this sort of new kind of big budget literary film was thought by many in Sweden to represent something that was particularly Swedish and particularly admirable, it's been this sort of relatively brief period has continued to be thought of as a golden age, which is a concept that people started using very early on and has sort of kept its place in many sort of film historical writings, that this was the golden age of Swedish cinema. There is no sort of easily available video version of The Sons of Ingmar, so I've snatched a bit from a documentary on Sjöström that includes some sections from the film. It's a story about a farmer who marries and The marriage is troubled. I mean, he thinks of marriage as sort of a business proposition, and the wife is uncomfortable with that, and they become more and more at odds, and finally things come to the head to a head to the point that she thinks that he's treated her so badly that she kills their son, their infant. They have an infant child, and she throws him from a rock, so he dies, and she is sent away, as we shall see. And it, but eventually, she is released from prison, and he realizes that it was in part his fault, that his lack of attention to her needs drove her to this desperate act, and they reconcile at the end. So, I mean, it's a very, very sort of almost extravagantly violent, emotional world that we are dealing with, but also it's one that's very psychologically complex and sort of doesn't fall easily into black and white categories, and that's part of what gives these films a feeling of maturity, which remains quite impressive. One of the people who have made no secret of his admiration for Sjöström is Ingmar Bergman, and you'll hear him on the soundtrack here. He comments about some of the things that Sjöström does that he thinks are particularly impressive.
Här kommer hon in för tinget för att hon tagit livet av sitt oönskade barn. Fängelseåren glömde hon aldrig det. Och medan solen vandrade över väggen i hennes cell tänkte hon på den dag då han skulle komma och hämta henne utanför fängelseporten. Ingmar Bergman minns alldeles särskilt det avsnittet.
Jag undrar ofta, hur gestaltar han de här märkliga scenerna i återseendet i Ingmarsöna med Harriet Bosse och Victor? Hur hade de planerat det där med att ljuset kom så rätt? Att de spelade hela tiden från solljus och inte mot solljus. Hur kom man på idén att komponera de här vidunderliga bilderna? Hur kom man till de här märkvärdiga, spänningsfyllda, sällsamma kompositionerna? Det är en hemlighet jag kan inte lösa det.
Now, the weird thing about the claim that this sort of group of films is particularly Swedish is that a number of the stories involved are not Swedish at all. So, I mean, if we look at Sjöström and Stiller's best-known films, Four from Each, we can see that actually that half of them are based on literary works by non-Swedish writers. So Terje Vigen is based on a Norwegian poem. Berg Eivind og hans hustru, the outlaw and his wife, is based on an Icelandic play. And in the case of Stiller, the Song of the Scarlet Flower from 1919 and the Erotikon from 1920 are based on a Finnish novel and a Hungarian play, respectively. The other four are based not just on Swedish works, but actually on works by Selma Lagerlöf. So her sort of material did sort of play a large part, but it's still, I think, problematic to, in a sense, to just see this as particularly Swedish. It may have something to do with the fact that Sweden is sort of the big brother country among the Nordic countries and tends to sort of view the other ones as sort of younger siblings. And sort of that, you know, that it's okay to sort of pull in their literary heritage as well, and present it with great quality, and that, you know. But this is something that particularly in Norway and Finland caused some consternation. And in many ways, the way that both Norwegian and Finnish cinema developed during the 1920s was very, very marked by the Swedish cinema, in the sense that, that the Norwegians and the Finns said, well, we can do this ourselves. And so they made films which were very, very similar to the Swedish ones, but had Norwegian or Finnish directors and actors and money behind them, but predominantly stories that took place in the past and that took place in rural areas, so you would have the opportunity to draw on the local landscape in order to give a background to the events that would sort of would resonate with the proper national spirit. Okay, I'll skip that. Stiller's sort of big breakthrough came with Sir Arne's Treasure from 1919, which takes place in the 16th century and in winter time, and which quite consciously draws on a well-known illustrated edition of the short novel by Selma Lagerlöf that it's based on, so that the illustrations for the story by Albert Edelfelt were sort of very consciously copied by Stiller in his work on the film, and in that way sort of made the connection to the literary background work on in a certain sense on the visual level as well. And Stiller has sort of made been overshadowed a bit by Sjöström, and partly perhaps because he died much sooner. He died in 1928, whereas Sjöström went on to have a long career, mostly as an actor after the coming of sound, and of course famously plays the main role in Ingmar Bergman's 1957 film Wild Strawberries, you may know, where he plays the old professor who looks back on his life, and which was a film that was certainly informed by Bergman's admiration for the work that Sjöström had done in the silent period. But while Stiller was, he made films of various different kinds. Some of them are sort of sophisticated comedies that are set in urban settings. Others are sort of rural dramas, more in line with the films that Sjöström made and which made Svenska Bio famous. But Stiller had a particular sensitivity to the light, and both The Song of the Scarlet Flower and Johan from 1921 were shot in the very, very north of Sweden during the summer, where the sun is up for nearly all. There are even at night the sun doesn't or at least the light doesn't disappear entirely, and it gives a very, very particular quality to this sort of northern midsummer light. And he tried to capture this in the films, and also in various ways use the landscape to support the drama of the story. And this is particularly clear, I think, in Johan, which is about Johan marries a much younger woman who's an orphan and who's actually been sort of brought up as a serving woman on his own farm. But when she comes of age, he falls in love with her and he marries her. I need to plug in. It tells me the problem is that he's not really that impressive of a man, and the woman has instead fallen in love with this big, strapping, handsome, traveling lumberjack who only comes around during the summertime and is incredibly conscious of his own attraction. Let me just get that. Boom, 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 boom. That's the wrong one. Sorry. Here. So. Here comes the lumberjack. Traveler gets room for the night on this farm. So So Stiller here, he sort of quite consistently frames the lumberjack with wide bodies of water behind him. And the first thing you see in the movie, you see him rowing a small boat down a fast-moving river, and he stands up in the boat. And so this running water is something that he is consistently connected with throughout the film, showing that he is a free spirit, but also a dangerous person. And when Marit runs away with him, they take off on the river, and he takes the boat into these very violent rapids, and there is sort of a clear sort of erotic suggestiveness to the wildness of the rapids involved. So in this way, the natural surroundings are used very, very cleverly and elegantly to energize the drama. But it's also worth remarking on this sequence here how very, very smoothly it works, and how Stiller sort of presents the situation with sort of complete control of shifting back and forth between views of him, views of her, changing the framing, moving closer as the situation changes, because he, like Sjöström, had come out of a tableau-style environment, but he Stiller very, very quickly sort of grasped the power of the more editing-based American cinema and was able to put that to use in a way that seems completely natural and free-flowing. And the sort of the naturalness with which Stiller does this, I think, is deceptive, because for a lot of European directors, mastering this kind of American editing with shot, reverse shot, and so on was quite difficult. And we can see this in German and French films from the 1920s, that there were a lot of established directors who found it very, very difficult to master this. And so they cross the line, and there are all sorts of things that show that they didn't really quite get it. But Stiller got it immediately, and he uses it very, very skillfully to tell stories of the psychological and in many cases particularly sort of the erotic tensions going on between the characters. I'm going to show you a bit of the boat ride as well, because it is quite impressive also. Thank you. Sure, let me go. Hold on, Lynn, because now the worst is coming. That's the poor abandoned husband. Will he never see Marit again in this life? Thank you. I think I'm going to stop it here, but the boat ride does go on through even wilder rapids, and he gets thrown overboard at one point, and she has to sort of leap up and pull him from the water. Being a film actor then wasn't sort of a completely danger-free profession. This kind of action sequence with a confrontation between one of the main characters and a dramatic natural hazard was something that Stiller had first done in Song of the Scarlet Flower, where the hero has to ride a log, stand on top of a log, and go through sort of a similarly crazy stretch of rapids, and it became sort of a fixture of many of these rural dramas were made over the next several years. Synnøve Solbakken was made by another company, Skandia Film, which was started in part to to try to emulate the success that Svenska Bio had with their films, and they tried to follow the same formula, and they made a number of films that were based on well-known literary works that for the most part were films that took place in dramatic natural surroundings, but the literary connection was the most important thing. But they also to some extent drew on well-known artworks. So in Synnøve Solbakken we get several scenes that Synnøve Solbakken is based on a story by the Norwegian Nobel Prize winner Bjørn Stjerne Bjørnson, who had died in 1910 but was sort of the best known Norwegian writer after Ibsen. This is an early story of his, but there are several scenes in the film that are directly based on well-known Norwegian paintings from the period of romantic nationalism in the mid-19th century. In this way, the film very consciously draws on this Norwegian cultural heritage. But of course, it was a Swedish production. It was also shot on location in Norway, and it caused a lot of consternation in Norway, where a number of critics were up in arms about this and said, you know, the Swedes are stealing our natural heritage. And of course, Norway had only become independent of Sweden in 1906, so they did have sort of issues there that hadn't been sort of completely worked through. But in that sense, sort of the Norwegian cinema of the 1920s can be seen to be sort of largely really sort of a response to Synnøve Solbakken, and many of the films are films that are done in the same mold as this one. This is the start of the film. Can you read that? In a large valley there might be a site way up high where the sun shines from dawn to dusk, and those living closer to the mountainsides who get less sunshine would call such a place a sunny hill. Solbakke means sunny hill in Norwegian. This tale is about someone living in such a place which also gave name to the farm. So, we try again. Like this. owners were Haukianers, or they were called readers. This is a particular Christian sect, as they were more busy reading the Bible than most others. The husband was called Guttorm and the wife Kjarn. They had a single daughter, Synnøve. And then credits. On the other side of the valley, right beneath the tall mountain, there was a farm called Grandvig. Solbakken. Don't you know that's where the trolls reside? There's a living little girl living there, Synnøve. She's the goddaughter of the troll king, who joins their feast every night. We'll get to more trolls in a moment, but before that, this here again. Obviously, we have the makings of a romance between the girl from the sunny side and the boy from the wrong side of the valley. And again, that's a motif that's recurs repeatedly. That you have this. A sort of typical melodramatic setup, rich girl, poor boy, but they manage to get each other at the end. And not in Synnøve Solbakken, but in many of the other films, this is sort of linked to a situation where the poor boy has to carry out some sort of feat, scale a high cliff, or ride down a wild river, or capture a magic moose or whatever. But this film has also many motifs from this film recur in a number of other films during the 1920s, including one made by Dreyer, which I'll mention briefly tomorrow. This, you can't read that. Sorry about that. No, not this one. Where did I go? Here. So. Both Dreyer and Christensen go to work for the Swedish film companies at the end or just before 1920. I'll say more about Dreyer tomorrow. Christensen, as I said in the earlier lecture today, goes to work for Svenska Bio. Svenska Bio had become super successful as a result of with these films that Magnusson had this new policy and the films by Sjöström and Stiller were really, really big successes, and that gave Magnusson and Svenska Bio hopes for even bigger things. And so at the end of 1919, Svenska Bio and Scandia, the company that produced Sunnyvae Solbakken, merged to form this really, really large big film company, and they hoped to make films that would be competitive in the world market, but instead, of course, the world market was flooded with cheap Hollywood films, not cheaply made, but because they had already paid themselves off in the American home market, Hollywood was able to distribute the films much more cheaply than the European companies could, and so the dreams of big international success turned to ashes for the Swedes quite rapidly. And they also made some questionable financial decisions, and one of them arguably was to hire Benjamin Christensen because Hexen, his sort of semi-documentary about witchcraft beliefs was insanely expensive. He worked on it for 2 years. He had the Swedes buy him his own studio in Copenhagen so he could work there away from the bosses in Stockholm and just keep spending money without anyone stopping him. And he rented other studios, he built expensive sets, and made lots and lots of experiments to create some really jaw-droppingly impressive special effects to show the supernatural events. But the problem was that the resulting film was shown in Sweden, it was shown in Denmark, but in most other places it was banned by the censors, because the depiction of the witch's Sabbath, and I'll show you some of it, was considered to be much, much, much more explicit than anyone could accept. But it's a wonderful film, and Christensen clearly enjoyed the project. He stars as Satan himself, and very, very obviously enjoys the role. The scene I'll be showing you, an old woman has been captured by the Inquisition or by these witch hunters and been tortured and forced to confess to her activities as a witch. And even though the film makes quite clear that it finds these beliefs completely crazy, and it's clear from the context that it's something that she makes up to avoid being tortured further, Christensen still sort of makes the whole thing come alive and shows us a really richly realized a depiction of a witch's Sabbath, which sort of may undercut the message of the film slightly, but it's wonderful to look at. And with that, I will end today's lecture, and tomorrow we'll meet really early at 8:10. Okay, and that will be about. It will be about Gaia tomorrow morning then. But for now, I will leave you with Benjamin Christensen's Hexen.
vagnen.
Right, to be continued.